Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Every day on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. This is what you will hear on today's program. First, in the Higher Education Report, Pete Musto tells us about the debate over tenure for professors at public universities in the United States. Some lawmakers are calling for an end to this kind of guaranteed employment. On our popular Words and Their Stories program, Anna Mateo tells us about La La Land, also known as the City of Los Angeles. Then, on our American History program, The Making of a Nation, we look at some of the social and cultural issues of the 1980s. So let's get started. Here is Pete Musto.
The idea of tenure has long been important to American higher education. In the 1700s, religious groups operated most colleges in the United States and, before that, Britain's North American colonies. Often, college officials would remove employees who spoke about subjects that were in conflict with the school's teachings. By the late 1800s, it became common for individuals who gave large amounts of money to a college to have powers similar to those officials. Then, at the start of the 20th century, the presidents of three private universities decided their professors needed more protection. The three universities were Harvard University, Columbia University, and the University of Chicago. Presidents felt professors needed the freedom to explore difficult issues, which would, in turn, help better educate students. So they created a system to reduce the ability of donors to influence the removal of professors. This system is called tenure. After World War II, most U.S. colleges and universities established tenured teaching positions. A tenured position was meant to last as long as a professor chose to teach at the school that offered it. But during the 1950s and 1960s, some American professors were dismissed for expressing their political beliefs. Then, in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court decided a case involving tenure. The court ruled that a tenured position must be based on a written contract between a professor and a school. It also decided that any school wishing to end a professor's tenure had to do so through a process similar to a trial. But some people call tenure a guaranteed job for life for professors and, in some cases, a waste of money. One of tenure's critics is Rick Bratton, a member of Missouri's State House of Representatives. Last month, he proposed a measure that, in part, bans tenure for anyone who starts teaching at a public university in Missouri after January 1, 2018. Bratton says he proposed his bill because the costs of higher education have risen too high. He calls tenure at public universities un-American and an unnecessary cost to taxpayers. Tax money helps pay for operating costs at public universities, including professors' wages. Bratton argues that once professors earn tenure, they often care less and less about how well they teach.
You cannot tell me that every tenured professor is absolutely doing everything to the fullest extent. That's not even possible. So to have a system in place that protects that person with a guaranteed lifetime employment, it works against itself, because then we have no ability to shed those who just shouldn't have made the cut, but they slid in and now they have this protection.
Bratton is not alone in his opposition to tenure. Iowa Senator Brad Zahn has proposed banning it in his state. And Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker weakened tenure protection laws for the University of Wisconsin in 2015. Not every professor receives tenure. When a university offers a position to a teacher, that teacher is first called an assistant professor. This means they are on the path to tenure and must spend the next 7 or more years proving themselves. It means they must prove their teaching abilities and the value of their research. After that period, school administrators and other tenured professors in the same field decide if the candidate should receive tenure. Then, if approved, that person becomes an associate professor. In 2013, the American Association of University Professors reported that the number of tenured positions at U.S. schools has dropped since 1975. Beginning in 1915, the AAUP was one of the first organizations of college professors to fight for academic freedom. Bratton claims some professors seek tenured positions so they can enjoy employment for life. He adds that giving tenured professors power to judge tenure candidates makes no sense. In no other industry do members of that industry police each other, he says. And no other business guarantees a job for as long as an employee wants it. Yet at least one other part of American society makes this promise. U.S. federal judges can hold their position for life. Also, it is possible for colleges and universities to dismiss tenured professors. Hans-Jörg Tied is the top official dealing with academic freedom and tenure for the AAUP. He says some schools have removed tenured professors by closing down their academic study programs completely. Also, schools facing extreme financial problems have canceled tenure contracts. And schools have removed tenured professors for legal and ethical violations, Tied adds. Banning tenure would work if every university administrator was completely interested in protecting their professors, he says. But that is not always the case. For example, the AAUP criticized Louisiana State University last year after the school removed a tenured professor of 14 years for making inappropriate statements. Tied argues it is the job of professors to challenge and sometimes even shock students to get them to think differently. Banning tenure at a given university will only weaken that school in the end, he says.
If you remove tenure, you're moving your institutions of higher education outside of the mainstream of higher education in the United States, and you will have a very difficult time attracting faculty members, because faculty members want to have the freedom to be able to engage in research and to teach.
And, Teed says, once a professor earns tenure and becomes an associate, their work is not over. They can still work to earn the higher position of full professor and beyond. Also, professors are not the main reason costs have gone up, Teed says. The real reason, he argues, is the growing number of school administrators and their salaries. However, not all professors want a guarantee of lifetime employment. James Weatherby is a professor of information technology at Texas Tech University. He has also earned tenure from 4 different schools and rejected it every time. Weatherby agrees with Bratton that the current tenure system can lead to professors caring less about the quality of their teaching. He also notes the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution guarantees freedom of speech. Public university professors who feel they have been punished for what they say or do can take legal action. This is true with or without tenure. Weatherby suggests a new system in which associate professors apply for a new, unbreakable contract every 3 years. Full professors would do the same every 5 years.
If you're doing a good job, then you're in good shape. Now, can you get caught in a political situation? Can you get caught up in a freedom of speech or academic freedom issue? Yes, you can. But most faculty can deal with an administration that's out of line within a 5-year period.
Weatherby says that schools will want to avoid any damage to their public image. For example, Mount St. Mary's University removed a tenured professor for comments he made against an administrator in February 2016. The university then removed that administrator and renewed the professor's position a short time later. I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we tell about common expressions in American English and explain how to use them. Today, we talk about expressions involving Los Angeles, California. Los Angeles is the biggest city in the western United States. It is the second largest U.S. city in terms of population, after New York City. So, Los Angeles is a huge city with people from many different walks of life. But for today's show, we are going to focus on the dreamlike or ethereal part of Los Angeles. Los Angeles, or simply LA for short, can be an unreal place, a place like no other. For some, it is a city where big dreams come true. For others, it is where their dreams die in a cloud of smog. LA is home to the U.S. motion picture and television industries. Some Americans like to call it the entertainment capital of the world. The LA neighborhood best known for films and movie stars is Hollywood.
Hooray for Hollywood. That phony super coney Hollywood.
Millions of people visit Hollywood each year. No trip to Los Angeles is complete without seeing the word Hollywood spelled out in huge letters on a hillside. And many actors dream of having their name added to Hollywood's Walk of Fame. This brings us to a nickname for Los Angeles, one that is also commonly used as an expression, La La Land. La La Land can be any place that is fun, far from serious, and out of touch with reality. You can use this expression when talking about the mental state of someone who does not understand what is really happening. You might say that person is in La La Land. La La Land is also the name of a 2016 movie. It tells the story of a man who wants to be a musician and a woman who wants to be an actress. They meet and fall in love in Los Angeles. The name of the movie suggests both the city's nickname and the state of being out of touch with reality. Now, there are many types of industries: automobile industry, farming industry, computer industry, and so on and so on. However, when people in LA say they work in the industry, they only mean one thing: making movies. Like any industry, the movie industry has its own set of terms and expressions. Some are useful outside of La La Land. Not only actors, many screenwriters dream of making it big in Hollywood. They write one screenplay after another, hoping for a big break, the opportunity of seeing their story made into a film and played out on the silver screen. To get money to make that happen, these writers need to pitch their stories. A pitch is a short description of a project you've been working on or an idea you have. You pitch your idea to someone who can help you with money or provide contacts to make it happen. Writers usually form a partnership with someone in the industry, such as a producer or director. These partnerships then pitch the project to investors. So in Hollywood, the pitch is about scripts and making a movie. But you can pitch anything that needs financial backing. You can even say you are pitching yourself if you are looking for a job. But back to the movies. Let's say your pitch is successful. The first person you talk to likes your idea. So you move up the line. You get to talk to bigs. In Hollywood, these are the people with all the influence and money. In other work situations, you might call them bigwigs, decision makers, or simply the money people. No matter what you call them, if investors like your pitch, they may greenlight your project. This would be the best news. In traffic, a green light gives the driver permission to move forward. In movies and in all other industries, getting the green light for a project or having your project greenlighted means you have permission and support to make it happen. After you get the green light, you make your script into a movie. You've made the big time. Again, you can make the big time or make it big in any industry, not just the movies. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
And now, The Making of a Nation, Society and Culture in the 1980s.
In some ways, the 1980s seemed like the opposite of the 1960s. The 60s were years of protest for social justice and change. Many Americans demonstrated against the Vietnam War. Blacks demonstrated for civil rights. Women demonstrated for equality. Many people welcomed new social programs created by the government. By the 1980s, however, many people seemed more concerned with themselves than with helping society. To them, success was measured mainly by how much money a person made. People wanted to live the good life, and that took money. The changes started to become evident during the 1970s. For a while, these years brought a continuation of the social experiments and struggles of the 60s. But then, people began to see signs of what society would be like in the 80s. There were a number of reasons for this change. One reason was the end to America's military involvement in Vietnam after years of war. Another was the progress of civil rights activists and the women's movement toward many of their goals. A third reason was the economy. During the 1970s, the United States suffered a recession. Interest rates and inflation were high. A shortage of imported oil as a result of tensions in the Middle East only added to the problems. As the 1970s went on, many Americans became tired of economic struggle. They also became tired of social struggle. They had been working together for common interests. Now, many wanted to spend more time on their own interests. This change appeared in many parts of society. It affected popular culture, education, and politics. In the 1960s, folk music was popular. Many of those folk songs were about social issues. But in the 1970s, there was hard rock and punk.
Here's Wonder Mike, Hank, and Master G, the Sugar Hill Gang.
And in 1979, a group called the Sugar Hill Gang brought rap music to national attention with a hit called Rapper's Delight.
And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie. Say, up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie, let's rock.
In bookstores, the growing number of self-help books offered another sign of social change. These books advised people about ways to make themselves happier. One of the most popular self-help books was I'm Okay, You're Okay by Dr. Thomas A. Harris. It was published in 1969 and led the way for many other popular psychology books throughout the 70s. Politically, the United States went through several changes during the 1970s. For most of the 60s, the nation was governed by liberal Democratic administrations. Then, in 1968, a conservative Republican, Richard Nixon, was elected president. Nixon won a second term 4 years later, but had to resign in 1974 because of the Watergate scandal. Nixon's vice president, Gerald Ford, took his place. 2 years later, Ford was defeated by Jimmy Carter, a Democrat who, until then, was little known nationally. The election showed that Americans were angry with the Republican Party because of Watergate. but they soon became unhappy with President Carter. They blamed him for failing to improve the economy and for failing to end a crisis involving American hostages in Iran. He lost his re-election campaign to Ronald Reagan.
Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
Reagan, a Republican, won two terms and led the nation during most of the 1980s. For many people, the Reagan years offered a renewed sense of economic opportunity. Reagan reduced taxes, which increased his popularity. But the national debt grew as he raised military spending to put pressure on the Soviet Union. The self-centeredness of many people in the 70s and 80s gave rise to terms like the me generation. And there was the rise of yuppies, young urban professionals remaking older neighborhoods in cities, often displacing poorer people. Popular entertainment at that time was often about financial success.
Premiering Sunday, April 2nd, Dallas, where money buys power and passion breeds conflict.
Dallas was a TV drama about a Texas oil family with more money and more problems than they knew what to do with. It became a hit not just in the United States, but around the world. Actor Larry Hagman played J.R.
Well, your daddy lacked the killer instinct. He forgave those who transgressed against him. People just weren't afraid of him. And he overlooked old J.R.'s golden rules.
And what might they be?
Don't forgive and don't forget. And do unto others before they do unto you. And most especially, keep your eye on your friends, because your enemies will take care of themselves. Oh, and one other thing. The oil business is a little bit like a poker game. It's good to get caught bluffing early on, because after that, somebody's going to call you when you got a winning hand.
And at the movie theater, there was the 1987 film Wall Street.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Michael Douglas played a character named Gordon Gekko, who earns his wealth by raiding companies and illegally trading on inside information.
Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Good triumphed over evil in the Rambo action films starring Sylvester Stallone. He played a troubled hero who had fought in Vietnam. The films were violent, but they represented a more positive view than society had shown in the past toward veterans of that unpopular war. In the 1980s, people came to fear a new disease that could be spread by sex or blood. It was the rise of the AIDS epidemic. At the same time, a new drug, crack cocaine, started a wave of violence in American cities. Technology was also on the rise.
You don't have to be a genius to use a computer. Let Computerland show you how easy it is to manage your own small business or home finances with the Atari 800. Record keeping, information, communication, and a world of new ideas from Atari.
Personal computers appeared in more and more offices, schools, and homes. The 1980s brought stardom to young entertainer Michael Jackson. And no history of the 80s would be complete without noting the rise of music television, better known as MTV.
That's our program for today. Join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.